Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we have such a fabulous show for you. We really should charge admission. And as fabulous as all of our other shows are also. But today we'll be speaking with whistleblower Sabelle Edmonds. She's the editor of the Boiling Frogs Post, founder and director of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and author of the acclaimed book, Classified Woman, The Sabelle Edmonds Story. She is the recipient of the 2006 PEN/Newman's Own First Amendment Award. Ms. Edmonds has been subjected to several government-asserted state secrets privilege orders, and the U.S. Congress has been indefinitely gagged and prevented from taking up her case through unprecedented retroactive classification orders issued by the Department of Justice. She is nationally recognized as the most classified woman in the United States. She has an MA in public policy from George Mason University and a BA in criminal justice and psychology from George Washington University. And today, Sabelle and I will be chatting about her new book, a fictional work called The Lone Gladio. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Sabelle Edmonds. Sabelle Edmonds, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Well, it's good to have you back on the show. So it was September 11th of this past year, so barely a month ago, you published a new book called The Lone Gladio, and it's a fiction book. I don't want to say nonfiction. It's a thriller, a mystery book, and we have to emphasize that it is a fictional book. But tell my listeners a little bit about the book and what was your process in writing it. And I read it. You sent me in a review copy. And I just want to say before you get into it is that I just saw a recent interview you did with James Corbett. And I'm not a big reader of fiction anymore, although I used to be. But I'm like you. I do pick up a book in the airport when I'm getting ready to fly, because it does help the time pass faster if you're just reading something that's, you know, not too deep and it's a mystery or a love story or a ghost story or whatever. But, you know, I picked up The Lone Gladio, and after a little bit of confusion in the beginning that I was having, wasn't your fault, it was really what they call a page turner. I couldn't put it down, and I have responsibilities. Whenever Christmas would come, my husband would get me the newest Stephen King book, and he would tell the kids, say goodbye to your mom, you know, until she's finished reading it, because that's the way I am. When I get a good book, I don't want to put it down. So it was fascinating. I could just, like, fiction just seems so hard to me. I write nonfiction. I was like, wow, you are an awesome storyteller, Sabelle. So tell my listeners about the factional book, I like to call it, and how you came to write it, which is really a fascinating story in itself.
Well, first, let me thank you for your kind words. It's really encouraging, heartening to hear such positive feedback, and coming from you, it means that much more. But as you said, I'm not a major fiction reader, unless it's a major good literary piece that has depth in it.
And
it's amazing because I have received so many emails and comments from people who say, oh, this is another great Ludlum book, people who read those types of books. And I have never read a single Ludlum book.
Yeah, me either.
And that I have created characters that are like Bornesque, which is one of the major character, the hero in Ludlum's book. And so that's really interesting to me as someone who has never read those books to get that kind of reaction. I mean, in positive way, but nonetheless, it's really interesting. The idea of writing this book actually came to me and began during my first book, my nonfiction book, the biography, Classified Woman, because I had a hard time getting this book published. The Justice Department and the FBI, they have this pre-publication review law, I would say rule, that anybody who works for them and gets clearance, it's the same thing with the CIA. If later, even if they get fired or leave the agency, or even if they were contractors, if they worked for them and held these clearance, they have to submit their nonfiction book to the agency, whether it's the CIA or the FBI or the DOJ, and give them 30 days or 60 days for them to review it with a black marker in hand and cross out anything that they believe to be either sensitive information or classified information. Anyhow, so I was obligated to do that. Unfortunately, I had signed all those papers during my employment with the FBI. And like many, many Americans, the majority of the people, I didn't even think twice about it. That was during my gullible, naive stage in life. Oh, yeah, well, this is the law enforcement. So, okay, I have no problem with that. All the eye openers took place after my work began with the FBI, and that was my awakening. Anyhow, I submitted this nonfiction book. 60 days came and passed, and more 60 days followed, and they wouldn't return it to me, despite their own regulation that says 60 business days. So I had to obtain attorneys. They contacted the Justice Department and the FBI, and they were told that the FBI and the Justice Department were not going to release a single word of this book, that the entire book was classified.
Jeez.
I mean, this is like... this is a book that 90% of it has to do with events that took place after I was fired from the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that battle between the attorneys going back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth. And finally, I came to this point that I had to make a decision. And by the way, I didn't put really anything that was justifiably classified in that book, in Classified Woman. And so I told my attorneys, I said, you know what? I fulfilled my obligation. I submitted to them what they are saying is completely ridiculous and unconstitutional. I'm going to publish it anyway and let them take me to the criminal courts and try me and let the jury hear that the FBI and the DOJ said every single word in this book is classified, because I want to see how they're going to justify it.
Right.
And at that point, I went to the top 3-4 publishers, and they said, wow, this is a great book. However, we will not publish it unless you bring us the FBI and DOJ's pre-pub review consent saying that they don't have any problem with you publishing this. And I said, well, I already told you they are not giving this and the permission, and it's unconstitutional, and I have my attorneys, and I'm the one who will be taking the risk. They said no, they would not publish it because then the FBI would come after them and or come and take the whole book off the shelves, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole fear factor, and so they were not willing to publish it. I decided to self-publish it, so I put together my own team, you know, editors, proofreaders, the interior designers. I had to take out a small loan to pay for all these services because I wanted the book to be solid in terms of being produced right. You know, you can write it, but you do need a good editor. You do need a good proofreader. I mean, those, that it's a process, and it needs some professional expert hands when you write a book, no matter how great you are, which I was not great in any way. But during that entire process, I found out for the first time that if I were to write a fiction book, I don't have to submit it. And that's the case for everyone who has worked for the CIA or the FBI.
Right.
And during that stage, before I made the decision to self-publish my first book, I said, you know what? If they continue this and they come and really ban it, then I'm going to sit down and write a fiction book, you know, and I will say that it's fiction. So the idea was conceived 5 years ago when I was going through Classified Woman and publishing it. So as soon as I finished the book and the book was released, my first book, I sat down and I said, now I want to write the real book without any of those worries of, oh, this has to go to the FBI's pre-pub review and tell a story the way I want to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Tell a story the way that it is 100% honest and sincere and tell a story that has never been told in any way, whether it's in nonfiction or fiction. Because I don't know of anybody else from the intelligence and the law enforcement community who has sat down and written such a book. Maybe there are, but I don't know of. I have read several books from former insiders, but usually they are overtly sanctioned. You know, you have, I don't know if you're familiar with, I believe his name is Shure, and yes. He used to be the CIA, and he published his book because supposedly the CIA was not giving him the permission, the review, etc., pre-pub review, and he called it published by or written by the anonymous. So, of course, he got tons of money from some of the top two publishers. And nobody did anything to him because everything he put in that book was actually what the CIA wanted to be put out there.
Yeah.
It became a great marketing scheme.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the website, the pseudo websites like Anti-War, they kind of displayed it big and of course, backed by all the CBS 60 Minutes and all the major networks, etc., for a book that was supposedly forbidden. In real life, in the United States, it doesn't happen that way.
Right.
It doesn't happen that way. So that's how the idea began. And then I started writing the book as soon as my first book was released. And I started working on it nonstop. And The Lone Gladio was born.
Well, I think this might be a good place then to talk about the Gladio B program. And we were talking before the interview, and it just like occurred to me, the Gladio B program is like the U.S. deep state working with it's now become a war on religion. But the U.S. actually works with these people to foment, to me it seems like they recruit people who are on the side of the U.S. And then these Muslims or Arabs like go to recruit people who might actually have some fundamental differences with the U.S. and then they're used to, I don't know if I'm explaining this right, they're used to foment this opposition or, you know, it's terrorism or whatever you want to call it to get the U.S. war machine involved further into more wars. Did what I just asked you, does that make any sense to you? Maybe you
no,
can make
absolutely.
Sense.
And it's loaded. And I would like to respond to it in several, maybe different segments. One is we, the United States, the Western world, but mainly led by the United States, have been engaged in these types of operations for a long time. I mean, if you look at during the Cold War era in late 1970s, around 79, 80, we said, okay, we are going to train and put together and arm and support and give publicity to this sect in Afghanistan that later became Al-Qaeda, but for about 10, 12 years, United States, we call them the freedom fighters, the Mujahideen.
Was that the so-called Gladio A program?
No, the Gladio A program started at the early stage of the Cold War in 1950s. Okay. And the Gladio A operation, which is a confirmed case, a lot of people still think it's conspiracy because it has really never been covered by the mainstream media. But through the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, some documents have been released, and the major, political figures in Italy and in UK who have later come forward and said, yes, we did have such an operation called Operation Gladio. Operation Gladio was more of a covert operations and not a militaristic operation. And they're also referred to as the NATO's stand behind army. And the theoretical on its face value explanation definition of it by the deep state itself was we put in place these cells in places in Eastern Europe, all over actually Western Europe as well, including Italy, these cells that if something happens, and let's say if the Soviet Union comes and invade them, they can work for us and do things from the inside. Well, that was just the theoretical cosmetic explanation of Operation Gladio. The actual operation was false flag operations and synthetic terrors, and to sway public opinions, okay? For example, there would be some bombing. They even did that in South America, and there would be a bombing there that the Western governments, led by the United States, would link it to the Soviet. That was done by the communists,
right?
Or people posing as communists, creating these events, these terror events, in order to sway the public opinion and have the public, and we know how it works. It works very well. They hate those communists. It's very similar to all the movies made by the Hollywood, That is, how many movies were made with, Stalin and the way all the Russian KGBs were depicted, Similar thing. It was more of a synthetic terror, false flag operations, and psychological warfare than actually an overt war. The overt war, such as what we did with the Mujahideen, which later it changed form, was during that period, these were the same religious people. They were the Muslims, and we helped bring many people from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, into Afghanistan, and militaristically trained these people against the so-called communism and the Soviet Union.
Right.
But later, and all along, we knew who these people were, okay? We knew that they were Muslim. We knew that what they believed in. And suddenly that label of the exact same people changed after the fall of the Soviet Union, and of course with the 9/11, as these were the Al-Qaeda. So the brand changed. They no longer refer to them, the United States, as the Mujahideen. They were the Al-Qaeda because, hey, we built up Mujahideen as the greatest people on the planet, freedom fighters. We had to change the brand and make that Al-Qaeda and point to them and say they are the enemies. Well, a lot of those people, their leaders, their commandos, were the people that worked for us. They got paid by us. They were on our payroll.
Right.
Okay, and that includes Osama bin Laden. That includes Ayman Zawahiri. And bring it back today, the similar brand switching the brand, and I'm going to refer to the term marketing a lot here, started happening with this new boogeyman, ISIS, ISIL,
right.
Because as you know, Cindy, especially in the last 2-3 years, somehow that impact and the effects of that term Al-Qaeda, the terrorist Al-Qaeda, started kind of getting thin. People kind of stopped reacting the same way they reacted to the Al-Qaeda and how it was covered in the news media the first few years after 9/11. And as we know, starting 3-4 years ago, we the United States started training these different sects, the supposed liberation movement against Assad,
right,
in Turkey, in Jordan, okay? And they are Muslims. They are, you know, they are Muslim. And I'm going to refer to that again later and make some parallels with what the reality is on the ground. And we armed them, we trained them, we directed them in these military camps in Turkey, in Jordan, put it in there, and then we said, okay, it's time. Al-Qaeda brand is not working as well. Now let's switch and make it, you know, IS. Plus, Al-Qaeda was just a noun, a name, Al-Qaeda. But when you make this Islamic State, IS, you actually directly put the religion, the name of the religion, in there, in the label, okay,
right,
as part of the marketing scheme. I mean, the entire world, especially the Western world, they are referring to some ferocious, awful terrorists that are beheading and raping and committing all these murders, and they are referred to as Islamic people. It's about religion, okay?
I just heard on NPR yesterday that the IS, whatever we want to call it, has admitted to us enslaving thousands of people.
Well, of course. I mean, it has to be built that way. I mean, for it to work, for it to become, and we know that if you look at the headlines, Dick Cheney just came out and said that the attacks they're going to put and they're going to bring and direct toward the United States, the IS, is going to be billion times worse than Al-Qaeda. And then we have the former CIA director saying that this is going to be at least a 30-year war. And we are facing major threat inside the United States from these people.
Jeez.
And while we are looking and reading this, we need to go and look at the stock market and see what's been happening. Okay, within the stock market, the stock prices for all the military industrial complex related companies, you know, whether it's the Boeing or SAIC, they have gone up tremendously since this whole new marketing began with ISIS, okay? And when I travel a lot to Middle Eastern countries, and even after 9/11, there were people there that were saying, you know what, this is going to turn into the crusade and the crusaders. This event was allowed or made to happen, 9/11, so that they could, and this is the United States, declare war and justify it, their declaration on Islam and the Muslim countries, and link everything to the Muslims. Well, just the term and the name used for our website, news website, Boiling Frogs Post, if you start looking at the news article about 2-3 years ago, you see that they started warming up people to that whole notion. You start seeing the term, the Islamists did this. The Islamists did that. I mean, the first few years after 9/11, we didn't see it much. It was Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda. But you see that it's making it slowly into the news articles. Islamists, the Muslims, okay? Now, showing the women in there. And let's talk about some of the criminal conducts by these people, okay? They are killing people and they are raping people, correct? Supposedly they are even using chemical weapons. The pictures are popping up now on the Twitter. And every single one of these events, whether real or not, or exaggerated or not, they are being reported as the Muslims, the Islamists, the this, right? Now, what if we were to do the same thing with every single news associated here, let's say with the United States, and pair it up with the word Christian, okay?
Right.
And look at even throughout the history. Put all the pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, the famous picture, the naked children are like running from the atomic. You know that picture, right?
Yeah.
Now, imagine that headline above saying the Christian soldiers of the United States did this, okay? Then you fast forward and then you put on the pictures of the My Lai massacre, okay, and the articles about those horrifying rapes and torture and murders that committed by the U.S. military, and put the word in there, in the headline, just insert Christian there, okay? And then every day or every other day, we see reports that our drones bombed this area in Pakistan and 6 civilians were killed. 3 of them were babies, right? Why don't we insert the word Christian there, saying, because look, who are the pilots and what is the United States military? It's not the military of Muslim country, right? It's a majority Christian country.
Mm-hmm.
What if we change every single headline regarding the civilian deaths, regarding, let's say, what happened in Abu Ghraib, put the pictures in there and say the Christian soldiers, the American Christian soldiers did this. I'm talking about those horrifying pictures of Abu Ghraib. Okay? And then you see how the world is going to view Christians. Let's pair it up and see what happens. Well, this is exactly what the United States and the main and its tentacles, mainstream media, has been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So are there some rapes being committed by these people? Sure. Has there been many rapes and murders committed by the U.S. military around the globe? Okay, the black sites and the tortures. Why don't we put with every one of those incidents, the word Christians, okay? It's such a horrifyingly wrong thing to do because this in no way links or relates to the religion. But if you go and look at the comments, whether it's in RT or elsewhere, you see that the psychological warfare and the marketing by the mainstream media per order of their bosses within the U.S. deep state has been working. You know, they are saying, look at these damn Muslims. This is what Muslims do. Mm-hmm. They behead people and they rape women and they take the knife and they behead people. It was a horrifying, if it was real, that video or several videos,
right. It's
horrifying, right? But how horrifying are the pictures of the murders we have been committing in the past more than half a century? How horrifying are those pictures? Okay.
Well, not only that, but, you know, Obama and his Obamas, if you want to use those terms, are like bragging that he has this coalition to go after ISIS or ISIL. And Saudi Arabia is part of that coalition. Saudi Arabia beheaded like 19 people last month.
Right.
Hello.
But, you know, have you seen any pictures of those beheadings ever in the U.S. mainstream media?
I don't think
Not
so.
One. Let's say our NATO ally, Turkey, when they engaged in almost genocidal gassing and murdering the Kurds, the Kurdish minority in Turkey, and especially in late 90s, not a single picture made it into the mainstream media. So you would see that we never get to see the videos or pictures of these babies and grandparents blown into pieces with their intestines out in Afghanistan or Pakistan by our drones, okay, by our Christian soldiers. We never get to see those pictures. Now look and see how many pictures and videos are being shown around the clock of these Islamic and the Islamist people committing these acts. So it goes beyond hypocrisy. It is by design. It is beyond hypocrisy. And if the real true alternative media, and as you know, Cindy, there are not many of them, and the media in general, if they would equally treat all these acts, as you said, with Saudi Arabia, with Jordan, okay, with countries that we are giving billions of dollars, what if every single day when we reported Israelis killing Palestinians, okay? Many, many babies, many, many children, okay? Innocent people. What if every headline said that the Jews or the Jewish people or the Jewish soldiers of Israel doing that?
Right.
Can you imagine the outrage? Can you imagine all the lobbyists and the power, Israeli power, the campaign they would say, saying how anti-Semitic this
exactly.
is? Why in the world would we? Well, how many of the soldiers, Israeli soldiers who committed, even the human rights organization with all their hypocrisy and being despicable, had to say, yes, this is genocidal. This is war atrocities. These are war crimes are committed by Israel, right? What if they, I can tell you this, there was not a single Muslim soldiers who did that with Israel, with the Israeli soldier.
Right.
And there were not many or any Christian soldiers.
Right.
So those soldiers happened to be Jewish, okay? And the people who ordered these types of war crimes, these actions, were Jewish people. Is this a war of religion? I would hate it equally. Don't make it Jewish or Muslim or Christians or Buddhists. How about the rapes that have been reported, these gang rapes in India, okay? Because right. currently it's not within our marketing scheme, Cindy. They don't say, for example, the Buddhist Indians are committing these rapes. Because it's irrelevant, okay? It is completely irrelevant. What if we start saying, okay, we know about the Catholic priests and the stuff they have done. What if they start putting all these and saying, okay, Catholics are the pedophile child rapists?
Right.
It's wrong. Yeah. And all these, two wrongs don't make it right. So I'm not saying let's do that, but I am asking people to get their blinders out and look at it and think, just think, engage in thinking, okay? And look at these different scenarios. Then you realize that this is by design, this is by marketing, this is what the psychological warfare is, this is what propaganda is, and this is how the synthetic wars get to be created.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And just like people should think, like, who benefits? Who benefits by the rise of, whatever we want to call them, in the Middle East now? And it's just all for the benefit of the war machine and profiteers and the deep state and things like that. And people just, like, lose their any kind of critical thinking skills. It's just pitiful. But let's just, like, bring, thank you so much for that analysis. Let's bring it a little bit back to your book. And I want to say one of the reasons I stopped reading thrillers, because I did used to read mysteries and thrillers. I'll have to admit I did read some Tom Clancy. I would never do that again. But the reason I stopped is because most of the time the authors make these people look like they're heroes. And if they do something wrong, it's for the benefit of the wonderful United States of America, so it doesn't matter. But not in your book. Your book makes these people out exactly the way I think they are, either boring functionaries or stone-cold killers. And so that's what I like the reality of your book. It doesn't make any apologies for the actions of the deep state.
No, you're absolutely right. And the theme of the clear-cut heroes, you know, where people can root for specifically designated heroes, seems to be the recurring theme in almost every single action thriller, spy thriller books written. Same thing with the Hollywood, you know. I mean, that was the case even with the cowboys and Indians once right. upon a time.
Right.
And or, you know, you had these cowboy movies where you had the white hat guys going after the black hat guys, you know, to do this very clearly established lines, which real life, you know, it doesn't work that way. And one of the things that I'm glad to hear you mentioning this, that it makes me feel like I have achieved that. The real life doesn't work that way. And this book doesn't have some clear-cut caricature heroes. You know, I call them the canned heroes, the pop mm-hmm. heroes. And because it doesn't work that way. And being the thriller and being packed with action, I without even trying, I believe I put so many of those philosophical and moral debates and questions I have inserted it in these. You know, for example, for me is another very important issue, what we have been doing, waterboarding and torture. And we have one character in the book, you know, torturing people per company's direction, mm-hmm. you know, waterboarding and torturing and offering justification, saying the end justify the means. And of course, we have L.C. Simon's character here who has been, we find out, doing her own off-site operations by giving out the names of some awful, dark, bad people that you would think is totally justified to people on the other side and saying, you know, here are identifying these people for you. You can go ahead and take them out. And so we have Elsie telling this character, Greg, how awful his actions are, torturing these innocent people, etc. And then we have Greg turning around and saying, well, how about these operations that you have conducted? And she says, well, those are justified. I did it to the bad people. And the decision, like, who makes that decision? How those justifications are made? Are we even able to answer those questions, okay? Do we feel the same way when we hear about some awful rapist pedophile getting tortured and killed versus, let's say, some plain soldier somewhere, which goes to the questions of, you know, do we say that all lives are equal? And so this is what I mean by saying the importance of some level of depth in a book versus a lot of canned pop fictions that we grab and we start reading, and it's almost like they're all coming out of the same factory. Well, and yes.
I like the way that when I listened to or watched your interview with James Corbett, you said that you found yourself surprised because you were identifying more with the lone gladio, Greg McPherson, than with the character that I would think was really you, Elsie Simon, in the book. And at the end of the book, I was like, it seemed that Greg, like, did some stuff to act what I would consider honorably when he obviously is not. He's like an amoral person that doesn't
exactly
have any honor. And then I forget the character's name that what was one of your colleagues that you were having that Elsie was having a relationship with.
What was Ryan Marcello.
I thought, guy, he's kind of cowardly.
Ryan Marcello depicts your typical FBI, you know, street level agent, not the SES executive level. You know, those are the most corrupt, awful ones. That's why they get to that level, the upper management within the FBI. But the street level law enforcement mentality, these guys that as kids they grew up, they wanted to be a sheriff and catch the bad guys. And those types of motivations led them to their, you know, to the career with the FBI. And we know that Greg refers to him as hot-headed, passionate, to a certain level honest, but, you know, without that depth. And as you said, with the CIA, we are looking at a totally different breed, because I got to know many, many CIA people, some of them analysts, which is a totally different category, but the operatives, people who do carry out those types of black operations, people who have been hired based on their qualifications that made them perfect for those black ops that involves the black sites in Poland, the torture, the waterboarding, false flag attacks, etc. And when CIA hires these people, and I know I'm pissing off many, many CIA operatives, maybe including some of the members of my organization, our organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, but I met so many of them, I spoke with so many of them, and what led them with the career in the CIA, and what led the CIA to weed through the pool and select them for these purposes, operations as covert operatives, had to do with those psychopathic qualifications or some really psychotic tendencies. They always look for people who are very good at lying, which is a definition of being a pathological liar,
right. Okay?
And that is a malfunctioning characteristic in any kind of human being, in human nature. At least that's what the population at large identifies. Oh, this person is a pathological liar. Well, that goes as a very big positive in the determination of you being selected by the FBI for these types of operations. And let's say if you lack conscience, I mean, we know that there are people, either because of the childhood trauma or, I mean, we still haven't found answers in the field of psychology to say nature, nurture, etc. It's a combination of both. They don't have conscience, really. They don't even blink. They don't lose sleep when they commit some heinous act. Some people are that way. This is similar to the serial killers. You know, there's thousands of TV series and movies made on the serial killers. And the profilers establish these profiles of these serial killers, right? Highly intelligent, especially the ones have been the worst serial killers, whether it's Ted Bundy or Kemp. So they say, okay, they are pathological liars. They are highly intelligent. They possess high IQ. They lack conscience, okay? They have these sociopathic tendencies. Well, if you compare those serial killers' profile for the successful serial killers, and if you compare it to the CIA operatives for black ops, I'm not talking about CIA analysts. You and I know CIA analysts. That's an administrative work. You would see so much commonality, Cindy. Okay, you see so much commonality. I knew one man, I still know him. He used to work for the military and then later was selected for black ops for the DIA. And later he was transferred to the CIA to carry out some of the highest level black ops. Okay, and he and I spent several sessions talking about things. And he said, well, look, my childhood, I was a result of, some awful childhood. Okay, let me put it this way, because the person violated my mother and my mother got pregnant with me and I was born and my grandparents raised me, but they always basically tortured humiliated me, saying that I am the offspring of that kind of a person. And by the time I reached age 18, I could have gone two different ways. I was in front of this fork, you know, and you're looking at this crossroad and there is this fork. I was either going to be, and he's an intelligent person and he's a very likable person. He can just joke, have a great sense of humor, okay? And he said, I could either have gone the route of becoming a hardcore criminal and successful at it, whether it's a con artist or a serial rapist or you name it, or I could utilize those and channel it and join the military. And I found a home for the first time in my life by joining the military. Right. And within 2 years, I was selected and promoted to do certain operations because of those, that, you know, my background and qualification. Then I made my way into the CIA for those operations. But this is the person who does not blink if he takes out an 8-year-old. It does not blink, giving water torture sessions 7-8 times a day to 4 or 5 different people. But that is the qualification, the requirements for the CIA operatives. And nobody would want to talk about this because, well, in people's minds, they think about 007 when you say CIA operative. You know, you look at the networks playing 24. These hunky 007 guys who are tough. Oh, yeah, well, their conscience is a little bit flexible, but right. They're serving their country for the patriotic reasons. And they are the guys with the white hat, Cindy. That's what right. They are being identified as.
And your anti-hero does not wear a white hat. But I was just thinking, like, okay, so people have, everybody has a job. It's like, say you work for Starbucks. So I'm going to go make a pumpkin spice latte. And then you have the people you're talking about saying, oh, I'm going to go blow up a preschool in Moscow. Okay. Yeah, and it's like the all in a day's work.
Right.
It's really scary to contemplate that these people are being like groomed and they're being culled out of the population and groomed to be these kinds of people. And there is really, like you said, there's really no religious aspect about this. It's an ideology to suit the elite or absolutely, whatever you want to call them.
Absolutely. Neither nationalism or the patriotism or religion, none of these factors are in play when you're looking at the bigger picture. You're looking at the forest rather than the individual trees. And unfortunately, it resembles more of the reality of facts than it does some kind of sci-fi fantasy, even though it may not come across as such to some people. I still want to read more reviews from readers who have read it and their reaction, especially people who are not involved in our irate minority groups, people mm-hmm. who have been paying attention to the alternative media and you know, the conspiracy theorists, us.
Right.
and as you said, it's very important who wins. You always, that's one of the first things my father taught me when I was a child, and it was you always try to first step back and try to see who has the advantage, who wins, really wins. I mean, not abstract, but really wins. And as you know, a lot of things are, if not all, measured by that dollar sign, by that currency sign. It's the money. It's the money. And people, they say, well, it's power. Well, money brings power.
Exactly.
How many poor, powerful people do we know?
Zero.
And so it's a way to reach that power, and that power then translates into more money. And that's what we have to look at and say, it's to whose advantage? And another big misconception out there, you know, people are looking at the puppets and at the stage, not the ones behind. They are looking at people, you know, phony people like Obama or Bush or whoever it is. I mean, they are not Panetta. Well, really, yeah, did these people enrich themselves? Of course. Look, when Bill Clinton left presidency, his office, his net worth was minus $240,000. Okay, I did a report on this.
Uh-huh.
He actually owed money. Within 5 years, their net worth went to $40+ million. Today, the husband and wife worth close to $200 million. Okay.
Jeez, yeah.
So you have to say, yeah, sure, they enrich themselves, but they are not the true beneficiary,
no.
The ultimate beneficiaries in this. And you don't ever get to see those entities. They never are in the center stage. They're always behind the stage, okay? And they don't always carry out the things with titles. I mean, even when you look throughout U.S. history, somebody like Henry Kissinger, okay, now he's going to bring libel suit against me. But with Henry Kissinger, you know, he's been out of the government with official title for now 30-plus years.
Decades, yeah.
But who has more influence, him, you think, in the policy arena and or let's say that the front face of, well, I don't know, just name any of those the mid-tier level, you know, State Department people or mm-hmm. the national security advisors, not the ones we see, but the ones we don't see, the ones that don't carry official titles. And one of the things you mentioned about, for some reason, and it was so peculiar to me, it was like mind-boggling, was that I find it easiest to write for a Greg character than I did for someone who resembles me the most, and this is the FBI linguist analyst.
Right.
And I brought it up with my editor, and he's been in this business for 30-plus years, and he said it's rare, but it's not unheard of.
Uh-huh.
And he has had cases, authors who have identified with the character least like themselves. And I mean, versus the ones most like themselves. Because if you look at it like a post-traumatic stress disorder, what I went through, all the trauma and everything, it kind of, I don't know, subconsciously influences you and makes you maybe step back from things that come so close to you in order to even be able to write it. When I was writing Classified Woman, it was the hardest thing, you know, to write that book because it was reliving the whole thing all over again. You know, and being all over traumatized because it was about me and it was the experience. And yeah, some of those experiences were good. I got to meet some people that otherwise I would have never met. I learned a lot. I'm more awake. But it was traumatic, and it was living that trauma over and over and over again during writing that book. That's a great thing about fiction. You don't have that. And I guess if I were to give or offer a possible potential psychological explanation for it would be it helps. It's a kind of immunes you to feel that trauma again and feel hurt if you put certain distance between yourself and the character that mm-hmm. resembles you the most, maybe.
Right.
Maybe.
Wow, so I totally identify because I wrote a book called Peace Mom, and I had to have a box of tissues with me the whole time I was writing it. It was very, and it's not even cathartic. It's just like reliving the trauma over and over. But maybe this fiction book you wrote was kind of a catharsis for you.
It was in so many different ways that itself was surprising for me. Well, of course, it's the sense of relief that comes being able to tell a story, fictional story, that helps you to put the real story of, you know, everybody, if you were to ask who knows of me, there are not many people, but if you ask them, they recognize or know me as the most classified woman in the United States. Uh-huh. But no one to this date in the mainstream media or anyone has ever said, why? I mean, she was there as a language specialist with the FBI for 6 months. Why in the world would they do all these gag orders? And really, that never comes into play, just the fact that that's the title, I'm the most classified woman. Well, to be able to step beyond that and to put a story that I could have never really done so in real life because of where we live and our government and all the ridiculousness that we face, the police state we face. So that was a good part. The other things that surprised me, and that is, you know, some people are much more forgiving and they are more pacifist in such a way that they would say, you know, you turn your other cheek, etc. And I realize that I'm not one of those people when it comes to these cases and when it comes to these kind of mass murder cases or major crime cases, whether it's the pedophiles who do some heinous things to children, whether it's some awful torturers out there who are doing things in these black sites, I'm not forgiving. I feel, and I'm being honest, I feel vengeful. And I felt that, okay, deep inside, I felt really good to see them taken out.
Right.
And I did take them out.
That's awesome. I know. It did kind of feel good for me, too, when those kinds of things happened in your book. Well, you, Sibel, you are a really gifted storyteller. And the end of the book kind of left an opening for a sequel. Are we going to see a sequel to The Lone Gladio?
I would love to. And that's going to be partly determined by the readers and their reaction. Because, for example, if this is not really received well, if it's, you know, not many people want to read it or et cetera, it would be saying, okay, well, am I doing it for some ego reason? Because, I mean, it's like a supply. I mean, do people like this? Is it accomplishing something? And that's always been the case. I know the commercial authors, they are seeing accomplishment in terms of the number of dollars or the return in their investment, but that's not the case for me. It is, I mean, I had some objectives communicating things that I see very hard to reach people when it's nonfiction, when you give analysis, let's say when you and I are talking about ISIL, they tend to block their ears. They don't want to, they just want to avoid you. They don't want to listen to you. They don't want to hear your voice. I don't want to ever hear Sibel Edmonds.
Right.
But would they react differently? Would it open their minds a little bit more if they're grabbing a fiction book and saying, well, that's a fiction, you know, for example, George Orwell's 1984 or Fahrenheit 451. The fact that it kind of frees them from all these false sense of nationalism. Oh, if I were to listen to her and tune into her, that means because she's bad-mouthing America. My God, I have been told that so many times.
Right. Yeah,
I have put my life on the line, okay, in this country, and that's what I believe I have done. But I'm being accused of right and left. I have become a little bit immune to that. She bad-mouths America. She's criticizing American foreign policy. She says, you know, Americans, the U.S. government did this because that really clashes with their false notion sense of nationalism or whatever sense of false sense of religious belief they have, but they tend to be flexible or slightly more open-minded if they're grabbing a fiction book. And maybe that would invoke some level of critical thinking because I don't know if you have been feeling the same way or not, Cindy, but it's been feeling like beating the dead horse.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's driving me crazy.
I totally feel like that.
With my news organization, I'm constantly preaching to the choir. Uh-huh. All of them are like you and I. And I am not getting those from the other side, the 96% or 92%, whatever is their percentage. And that's why we are seeing, as we talked about, the whole recurring theme over and over and over and over again, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all these false flag operations. And we say, well, why people don't learn? Because they don't give us a chance. They don't give the truth a chance. Maybe they feel it's going to hurt them, the truth. Well, not seeing or hearing or knowing the truth, that's what has been hurting us as a nation the most. So that is one goal objective I have. And if it is successful in that regard, then yes, I have, it will be a trilogy. I traveled a lot for this book. And for my next book, I would have to travel to various parts of the world for part two. And again, that's going to depend on the financial situation as well. But yes, the short answer is I would love to do that. I already have, I call it my bullet point stage. Uh-huh. That's how I start writing. Great. I have pages and pages of bullet points. Then I start building my story around them. And I have them. I have started the bullet points.
Well, you know, I think you should just write it for me. Because send me a chapter like once a week or something, because I want to know the continuing story, because I was really invested in it. So, Sabelle, I hope it's a huge success for you. It really is worth reading of all these aspects you brought out in the interview today. And it's just a really good book. So tell my listeners how they can find it.
Well, the website for the book is thelonegladio.com, and the book is available via Amazon, via Kindle, via Nuke. If people don't want to deal with any of those corporations, mm-hmm. I provide the book through my own website as well, including signed copies. So thelonegladio.com would be a good place to go, because there people can see all the links and various channels where this book is available.
I also congratulate you for self-publishing, because with my first experience with Simon & Schuster, I have self-published for the rest of my books. So anyway, maybe another time we can talk about that, because that's also a story.
Because I'm so proud of that, Cindy. I think it's one of the things that I'm most proud of. And it's not only challenging these corporations, but that the editorial freedom and the self of, you know, I don't know how to describe it, this accomplishment feeling that you get from it, because just like the mainstream media, a lot of these big, at least big, I'm not familiar, but the smaller ones, corporations such as, you know, Random House, etc., they are part of the propaganda machine, and they are pro giving people the expected canned stuff. If you deviate from the classic for them, and the classic being the canned, what is the establishment approved style and content, they don't want to look at it. And they line up all these editors to tell you, you're going to turn off the readers if you were to say that. I mean, if somebody starts doing that with me, I won't even have 10 pages. Because the restraints, the constraints that it puts on you, then you are not really being you and just pouring out sincere, honest, frank work that comes from you and establishes you as your own unique, original person. No, they want you to follow the classic mainstream's footsteps. And anything outside that, they poo-poo and they say, oh, no, there is no market for it. You have to identify your niche and market. When I was writing this book, I was free of any of those thoughts. What is going to be my market, niche market?
Right.
You know, these are the questions they ask you. I don't want to answer that question. I want to write that damn book.
Well, Sabelle Edmonds, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Is there anything else? You'd like any other links or anything else you'd like our listeners to know about?
No, I'm just, I really appreciate and I'm thankful for you to giving me this opportunity. And also when you publish it, please send me a link so I can put it at Boiling Frogs Post and the Lone Gladio website, because the only reviews and the interviews I have been getting into have all to do with alternative true media. I haven't been doing anything with the mainstream. So I would love to be able to feature this interview, both at my Boiling Frogs Post site and also at Lone Gladio site.
Oh, absolutely. We'll do that. And good luck. And I hope you, like I said, sell a million copies. At least.
Thank you very much,
Cindy. Okay, Sabelle. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for this week. I told you it was going to be fabulous. If you like what you heard, go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I can't even say my own name. CindySheehanSoapbox.com. And donate some money to keep us going and keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox on the air to get this kind of really nonpartisan and hard-hitting information out to people. And also go to the newsletter for this week and CindySheehanSoapbox.com and order Sabelle's book, because you'll be helping out Sabelle. You'll be getting an excellent book, as we said, and you'll also be helping out the Soapbox People's Network. So, as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller, Sabelle for writing a very compelling and wonderful book, and you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.